So we'll invite Ajahn Amaro to come up and just tie all the threads together. There's a Thai idiom. Oftentimes have Dhamma talks through the night, and then the last person who gives the Dhamma talk is the person who washes the Dhamma seat. They can lang tamat.
Pay my respects to all of the Ajahns who've been here, Longpo Mahaprasert, Dhamma Master Hung Lu, Dhamma Master Hung Shun, Father Damien, the assembled Sangha, lay friends, to the sisters from Amravati, from Dhammadharini, Alok Vihara, and everybody gathered here today. So it's a very powerful and delightful experience for myself in many, many ways, both having been part of this from its genesis, but also having moved on from it in that dimension as well. So it's a bit like the kind of the kid coming home from college and realizing that, you know, she doesn't need you anymore. The kid is done upped and growed and on their way. Speaking of gratitude and also considering where to begin, I'd like to first of all express my delight that Joseph Kapil Pabakaro is here, hiding at the back there. And when I stumbled into Wat Pananachat at the beginning of 1978 as a scruffy hippie off the beach, that he was the abbot of Wat Pananachat, and he was my first teacher. And so I wouldn't be a monk, and Abhayagiri would not be here in its form if it had not been for this good man. So it's been very wonderful for me over the last few years to be giving the opportunity for the two of us to co-lead retreats together at Amravati, and now on this particular trip, having this occasion of the 20th anniversary. Glad we didn't have to wait for the 25th to get Joseph out to the West Coast so he could visit the Pacific Hermitage and also come and join together with everyone here for this very lovely occasion. Also, so many people gathered together today, dear and old friends, as Lumpur Pasana was mentioning, you know, older, older, grayer, more wrinkles, and larger. There's more of us in several ways. So in terms of my own recollections or what comes to mind, also very striking listening to everyone today is the variety of histories and the differing memories of, it was 89. No, it was 1990. No, it was 89. I remember it well. Pardon my bad French. From Maurice Chevalier. It was June. It was July. but I also really appreciated Ajahn Kunadamo's reflections about it's not the memories that matter or the reliability of our information, but the qualities of the heart are what really matters. It's not the structures of our brains, our thoughts, or even the structures on this hillside. You know, we haven't even finished building this building. But as Lumpur Cha would say, you know, this is an ex-building. This is a broken building. Yeah, you'd hold up a glass like this and say, this is a broken glass. And in my ignorance, I used to think, I can't see the crack. How come it's still holding water if it's a broken glass? But he'd say, yeah, its brokenness is in the glass. Once, if you can see that it's already broken, then when its day comes, you won't suffer. So if you can see that it's already broken, then your heart will be at peace. If you think it's a glass and it's supposed to always be a glass, then you're going to suffer necessarily. having spoken about the unreliability of memories, I'll give you my own. Or some of them. Again, I will try not to be here till midnight. But it was very interesting how, of all the countries in the world, the only country I actively did not want to visit was the United States of America. Even when I was like 8 or 9 years old, it's like the one country I don't want to go to is America. So we create these little karmic links. And back in the 1980s, Lumpur Sumedho had made contact with Master Hua. And when he came back from that trip in 1981, I was at Chithurst Monastery. That was the main monastery that we had in England at that time. And he and Ajahn Ananda returned, and he made this very, Lumpur Sumedho made this very impactful statement. He said, "I always thought I'd never meet anyone else like Lumpur Cha, but I just met another one." And he talked about meeting Master Hua, and he also, because they are very productive in their publications, he brought back a box full of literature from the Dharma Realm Buddhist Association publications. And so at Chithurst, we eagerly devoured these books, and I became very inspired with Master Hua's teachings and the standard of practice, and for myself adopted many or a number of the practices that they kept and do keep to this day at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. So that was a very inspiring presence for me. But I never thought about wanting to come to America or to live here. Then late in 1989, my memory is it was after Master Hua and his group had visited Amaravati. But documentation, the printed word is telling me that my memory is faulty. But I had remembered it at the end of 1989, but I guess it must have been in early 1990. But after Master Hua and his group, he came with about 18 bhikshunis and bhikshus and some novices to visit Britain and Europe, and and also had invited a group of 10 monks to attend an ordination ceremony at City of 10,000 Buddhas, and so that there was a growing sense of connection from our community. This whole group of 10 monks had gone over from the UK to take part in the ordination ceremony in 1989 in the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And Lumpur Sumedho was talking more and more about the possibilities of opening up a branch in California. So at that time, we had about 5 or 6 maybe more senior American monks in the community. And so when I was sitting having a cup of coffee one morning with Lumpur Sumedho in his kuti, as was often the case, you pop in to pass on a message and spend like 45 minutes chatting over the state of the world and enjoying his very good coffee supply. And he said, "So what I'm thinking of doing next year, there's an invitation to go and teach with Jack Cornfield's group. There's a conference, The Joys of Monastic Life, that Susan was talking about, that Jack Cornfield has organized with Christian monastics and Buddhist monastics of various types. So I'm thinking of taking a couple of the nuns over and another monk with me and go to the conference, teach a retreat, and then leave the monk behind to spend a few weeks in the Bay Area to start a kind of temporary vihara and to see how things go." And quite instantly, I said, "Oh, so who are you thinking of taking?" Assuming it was going to be one of the senior American monks. And he looked at me and said, "Actually, Venerable, I was thinking of you." So that was one of those sort of feel the earth move moments. And up to that point, I'd never considered having any connection with the USA or California or any particular interest. So it sort of came out of the blue and in an unbidden way. And sometimes when things arrive unbidden, they're not expected, they're not asked for, they're not something that you've wangled. And I'm quite a good wangler. can steer things in my favored direction if I wish to. But when things come in that kind of unsolicited, unbidden way, there's a kind of an easefulness in that, because there's no personal investment. I wasn't like I was wanting to to get to California, even though I was very inspired by the City of 10,000 Buddhas and Master Hua's teachings and the practices, you know, I hadn't had any idea of actually coming here or being nearby. So that was the first part. So, and I recollect that conversation at the end of 89, but who knows? It did happen. Interestingly enough, Ajahn Sumedho remembers that conversation very differently. So he remembers me asking him if I could go to California. So maybe somewhere in the Akashic record there is the real history. But so just for the record, there are various different records. So that took shape. That was as Debbie was describing. Ajahn Sundra, Sister Jodhika, myself came over with Lumpur Sumedho. We went to that conference. And then Tom Stone was the first attendant, a good friend of Joseph Kappel and Debbie. He helped out, and they rented a little place, a little basement apartment, a sublet on Sussex Street. So the Buddha came to Sussex again. Since there's a BBC documentary called The Buddha Comes to Sussex. So, and that was what we did for the next few years, was I would come for a few weeks, a few months, and the Sangapala would rent a property in San Francisco and be there with myself and various other monks, and sometimes Ayamed Anandi was along with us 1 year. And that's how the momentum built. So it was a kind of virtual monastery. The people were there, but we didn't have a place. And to then fast forward a little bit, so Lumpur Cha passed away in 1992 in January. So things had been, taking shape very quickly, and it looked as though we were going to be ready to open up a vihara in San Francisco in May of 1992. I even prepared a little brochure to accompany the opening of the vihara, and then suddenly Lumpur Cha passed away. Also, various senior members of the community had disrobed and left, so suddenly it all was put on hold. I got an aerogram from Lumpur Sumedho in Thailand saying, well, I know that we're planning to open up the vihara in San Francisco in May, and I know that you've got a lot invested in this, but you know, Lumpur Cha has just passed away, Kirisaro's disrobed, Babakaro's disrobed, things are all a bit wobbly and uncertain, so this is not the time to open the vihara. So there am I reading this aerogram going, but, you know, we printed the invitations, you know. we've ordered the flowers, you know. But he said, no, the wedding's off. So then we carried on with that rhythm, and Sangapala, I publicly expressed my great gratitude for the extraordinary fortitude of all the Sangapala board members who are, helping to administer this movable feast. Suddenly, sort of, 9 months of quietness and then 3 months of hyperactivity. And that was not an easy thing to look after. So I put my hands together and expressed my gratitude that during those years that the board was really marvelous, incredible in holding it together. Then to fast forward then to 1995. So things had settled down by then. It was 3 years after Lumpur Cha's passing away. The community had stabilized a bit, and we had one of our regular Sangha meetings in England. This was 31st of May. I do remember these dates. 31st of May, 1995. And the Elders Council agreed, okay, Ajahn Amaro, we're happy for you to make your move to California. You can start looking for land. And we understand Ajahn Visuddhi, another English monk, is ready to accompany you. So you can set up a temporary foothold and look and see if you can find a place. So sahatu. So I was very grateful for that. So that decision happened on the afternoon of the 31st. Early in the morning of June the 1st, 1995, I'm walking down the corridor in the monks' vihara in Amravati. Ajahn Viradamo, who was the abbot of Amravati at that time, his door was open. He said, Ajahn Amaro, could you come in here a moment? I got some news for you. And so I walked in. He said, just got a phone call from Lumpur Sumedho in Long Beach in Southern California. Master Hua has just offered us 120 acres of land. What do you think about that? So, sadhu. So he afterwards he said, "I was really impressed with how cool you were in hearing that news." And I said, "Well, somehow it just wasn't a surprise, or it just seemed like, well, that's the way things work." So the land search took less than a day. And this is, Master Hua was on his deathbed at that time. He was extremely ill, and he passed away not long after. And so when Lumpo Sumedho had gone down to visit him with Dhamma Master Hung Shu, he was extremely ill and was very, very close to death at that time. So that offering came from him just at the very last days of his life. So that was the parcel of land in the northern part of this property, and that had had no power, no well, a washed-out access road. But then when we came to Master Hua's funeral in June, and I walked over it with Fred Kral and Debbie Stamp and Skip Blake. Well, when we walked, I mean, we kind of scrambled and clambered around under the bushes. And nearly finished off Skip with a heart attack. But even though it was extraordinarily rough and rugged and undeveloped, and even though it was completely irrational, something in my mind said, this is the place. This is our place. It's perfect. The rational mind would have said, this is ridiculous. You can't even drive a vehicle onto the property, you know. But something completely non-rational in the heart said, here we are. This is our place. And Peter was expressing, it was an extraordinary gift. Master Hua had acquired that piece of property 13 years before. He was of the habit to just pick up different pieces of property and take with an eye to using them for retreat places or Dharma way places in the future. And they'd picked this up in, I think, 1976 or 77. And I think Hung Shun was part of the group that... you'd acquired it about 13 years before and had never done anything with it. And so he just remembered. There's this 120 acres and Ajahn Sumedho is looking to start a forest monastery. So it was Master Hua's like parting gift. Say, here, Sumedho, take this. And as has been referred to a couple of times this afternoon, Master Hua had a very, very ecumenical approach towards spiritual life. And he'd said... on one very public occasion when we were all at City of 10,000 Buddhas, he said, it had been the dream of my life to bring the northern and southern traditions together again. And I never thought I was going to be able to do it until I met Sumedho. And so it was really wonderful that his parting gesture was, this is a good way to bring the traditions together, to actually put them side by side in the same valley. And he was a person of extraordinarily grand heartedness, incredible generosity. And he wouldn't use words like Mahayana and Theravada. He'd say, you can't use those words accurately. They're not appropriate, really. You can talk about geography. You can talk about northern and southern. That's fair enough. But so really, you shouldn't talk about different traditions or separate traditions. That's not appropriate or realistic. It's not true. So from that time, I tend to say northern and southern tradition rather than Mahayana, Theravada, myself, most of the time. So that was an extraordinary gift. And then, as Noel was referring to, there was during that period, and Noel and Fred were part of the board. Debbie, of course, was part of the board. Susan was still on the board at that time. And it was extraordinarily testing, particularly because the Sangapala had no money. Well, if I remember correctly, there was $25,000 in the bank when the property was given to us. And then once it was heard that we needed to buy another piece of land nearby just to be able to get, you know, onto the property and to have water supply or power supply, then it became clear that this property here was ideal. But the owner had said, you can either buy it or forget it. I'm not interested in renting it. So Sangapala realized, oh dear, we've got to come up with some money. They thought, well, if we get enough for a down payment, that should be okay. Then we found out that banks don't loan to churches because it's very difficult to foreclose on a church. It's very bad press. So they get around that by not loaning to churches. So then, not to go into too much detail, but what happened was a couple of large donations came in, and so that was encouraging. So then Sankarpala had $40,000, but then there was a lot that was lacking, like another 180 or 200,000. And so then a Thai friend of ours said, "Well, I've got a business. I can give you an interest-free loan. Yeah, no problem. Just let me know when you need it, and I'll sign you over the money as a loan." Oh, very good. So then Sankarpala went into escrow. And then a few months later, our dear Thai friend said, business is not so good. So I can't give you a loan." So at this point, I was traveling as Lumpur Sumedho's secretary around Southeast Asia and India, going to various conferences and giving teachings here and there. This was the fax era. So Mark and Fred and Noel remember long, long, long faxes being written and received from all kind of corners of Southeast Asia, trying to juggle what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And it was very tense and difficult times. But for myself, during that period, it was testing. Because I wasn't on the ground here, and B, because I didn't want to put people into very difficult positions, and large amounts of money were being spoken of. So it was testing, and I knew I tended towards idealism and over-optimism. So it'll be fine, it'll be fine. You touch wood with both hands, you know. But there was also underneath that that kind of reflexive optimism, there was this kind of faith that don't panic. hold steady and we'll see how things work out. These are good people, and you trust in the Dhamma, practice well, be honest, be straightforward, express your perspectives, listen to what other people have to say, and use the situation for your practice. The practice with it, and not think of it as something obstructing the practice, but to deal with those feelings of uncertainty, of trying to meet other people's cares and feelings and concerns and so forth. And as it happened, then somebody who was considering entering into monastic life stepped up, and who's in Thailand, said, "Well, I was thinking about monastic life, and I'm really sure about entering monastic life, and I just happen to have a house that I don't need. And I understand that you're trying to get this place in California. If it would be useful, I could put this extra house on the market. And if it sells, then you could use the money from that as an interest-free loan."
Really?
So without trying to jump too much for joy, I said, "Oh, well, thank you for that. That's very thoughtful. That's very kind. Let's see how it works out." And again, to cut a long story short, this good person went back to the States, and they put the house on the market. It sold very quickly. The money came through, and Sankarpala managed to close on the escrow only 2 weeks late. It was due to close in the middle of May, and it closed just at the end of the month. And then on May 31st, 1996, 1 year to the day after that Sangha meeting, we gave Ajahn Kurunadamo the eight precepts. That was the full moon of May, Visakha Puja. He took the eight precepts, and then June the 1st, next day, we loaded up the wagons. Rick Williams' truck was part of the caravan, and this electric green Honda Civic, which was the first monastery vehicle that had been Ajahn Kurunadamo's car at that time. He's red-green colorblind, so he thought it was gray. So it was a very kind of sparkly monastery car we had for a while. And June the 1st, we rolled up here. And it was quite marvelous because of the, after such a difficult passage and such emotionally and financially testing times, it had all come together in a very, very beautiful and straightforward way. So I'm suggesting there was divine intervention, but I was really, really happy the way the dice fell. So, and I once again express my gratitude to the resolution and fortitude of the Sankarpala board members. Noel Brewer was the treasurer at the time, and so he had a lot of responsibility to look after the numbers and to make sure it was all carried through. Fred, I think, was the president at that time. Debbie was the chief chief warrior and carer for all the details, making sure all the endless odds and ends, loose ends were tied up and taken care of. So sadhu, it would not have come together. And from that day, June the 1st, 1996, 20 years have now gone by, and it has been really, it's a cliche, but it's a dream come true. Yeah, and I've been visiting now every year or two since I departed in 2010, so it's nearly 6 years since I left. And it's really lovely. I come back and I think, now, is that Gambira or is that Kantiko? What's his name? One of them Sudhiro. Now, which is that? Or that's Suhajo. Which one's which? You know, they all look the same, you know. It's not the whole new generation of people have come in that I never saw before. And this is a wonderful, a delightful thing to me, to be able to see how this place has been born, it's grown, it's got a life of its own. And I do admit that I feel sadness to have been forcibly separated from Lumpur Pasano. That when I got the invite to go to England, both of us had when we got the news, both of us had the same feeling, which was, oh, I was enjoying that. And because along with the ancient Flemish expression of you can't have two roosters on the same dung heap. But I have a Flemish grandmother, by the way, so I can relate to the earthiness of the Flemish way of expressing things. But in Thailand, they, as Lumpur Mahaprasert would often say, they have an expression which says, you can't have two tigers living in the same cave. And Father Damien was talking about it, having the Ukrainian monastery and Bayagiri next door to each other. But Lumpur Mahaprasert was talking about it in terms of having a co-abbotship, that you can't have two abbots in the same monastery. But I must also... a couple of other little details I'll share with you, in case you're getting bored, is that I took the model of a co-abbotship from Master Hua's own life story. Because when he was a novice in Manchuria, in northern China, he stayed at a monastery called Three Conditions Monastery. And they had two abbots there. And every day, at your morning and evening recitation, if I remember correctly, the masters, then they bow in respect to the two abbots of Three Conditions Monastery. Right? Am I correct? The noble...
The abbot there, you say, the Changshi. And however, the Changshi master is Master Hua,
So maybe I misunderstood that, but it was a very useful misunderstanding. Because in Master Hua's biography, it's a very useful misreading. But it seemed like that he talked about these two masters who were both at this Three Conditions Monastery, and they had great respect for each other, and they deferred to each other, and they had a great love for each other, and they worked together. And you might be surprised, but even in Buddhist monasteries, there's occasional instances of jealousy, competitiveness, and the aim to put the other guy down so you can end up on top. So, jealousy is not unknown in Buddhist monasteries, unfortunately. I know this is shocking to many of you, but I took that model from that thing. Well, when in 1994, when Lumpur Pasano expressed an interest in coming to help, he was very hesitant because he thought, you know, he's senior to me, he's 5 years senior to me, and that if he came in to be involved in this adventure in starting a monastery in California, that he didn't want to cramp my style or sort of take over. And so we talked about it a bit, and I said, well, we could just be co-abbots. We could just sort of do it, lead it as a joint effort. And we didn't have any really example to follow. We thought, well, let's just try it and see what happens. If it doesn't work, we'll just do something else. So that effort to work as a co-abbotship, I feel, was extremely beneficial. And I really enjoyed it. And I think Lumpur Pasano did as well. So we have conspired to keep visiting each other since that time. But that was... following the example of you know, elders working together as a team as something that's doable. Also, I just want to say express my gratitude for Lumpur Mahaprasad. He talked about us meeting in 1991, but when we were given the land by Master Xuan Hua in 1995, I went to tell him. I said, Tanajan, you know, we've just been given this land in Redwood Valley in Mendocino County. And he said, oh, I know the place. I said, no, not Redwood City. This is Redwood Valley. It's a really tiny little town in Mendocino. He said, yeah, I know the place. I said, no. And it's really small. And it's not where the big trees are. It's not like the big redwood trees. It's a town called Redwood Valley, you know, getting very English. You know, speak slowly and enunciate, and then they'll understand. He said, yeah, no, I know the place. He says, my friend, Dr. Peter, lives there. And we had just met Peter LaRiviere and Mary Curran, who lived next door. We just had met them and introduced ourselves to them. I said, Peter LaRiviere? He said, yeah, Dr. Peter. And his wife is called Mary. I said, Mary Curran? Yes, Peter and Mary. Yes, they're good friends of mine. I said, what? You know, if you know how many Bay Area people even come up to Mendocino, let alone inland Mendocino rather than the coast, he said, yeah, they're my good friends. I go up there very often. So, and it turned out that he indeed, and Mary and Peter had dedicated their property to be a forest retreat for Ajahn Mahaprasad. So, again, not to get too sort of superstitious, but it was a very curious connection. That of all the people, all the people that he knew in Mendocino County, one couple, they're our next door neighbors, and they're good friends. And the first time we were walking through the property, we stumbled across one of their buildings and saw they had a set of Thai shrine tables and a Thai Buddha image. I think it was Debbie came across that and said, "Oh, our neighbors have got a Thai Buddha in their property. That's unusual." That turned out to be Ajahn Mahaprasad, who was good friends of theirs. And so it was an extraordinarily beneficial and a close friendship that we had with Peter and Mary. So also I feel it's good to mention their names at this time. They were very welcoming, and that they were both semi-former practicing Christians and also interested in Buddhism. So they were incredibly happy to be sandwiched between the Christian monastery and the Buddhist monastery. So Father Damien and myself did what we called a mixed blessing. A mixed blessing for the one of the buildings, the guest building on the Casa Serena land. And it was really interesting how our Thai traditional blessing ceremony was very close to their Ukrainian uniate blessing ceremony. It was sprinkling water and chanting and so on. So there are many strange loops have been involved in the evolution of this this beautiful place, and the arising of the buildings, and more in particular the formation of the community, the strength of the sangha here, the fact there's more ordinations tomorrow. People who've heard the teachings, they've decided to come here. Faith has arisen, they've decided to go forth into monastic training. That's exactly what we wanted this place to be. And how marvelous that it's come out in that way. And that, I quite honestly, I feel it's wonderful to be expendable, that you know, I'm a visitor. And when I left here, I left with one small bag and no ties. I very deliberately... not even neckties, and as the Buddha encouraged, like swans that abandon the lake, they leave home after home behind. I took that to heart and just left, and it's really a great delight to have left and to have no ties. People say, "Do you miss us, Ajahn?" No. Aww. It's true, yeah. but you shouldn't take it personally. Because it's just our training. This is how the Buddha encourages us to live. Like Ajahn Kurunadamma was very beautifully expressing, it's just the world of things we leave behind. But the qualities of the heart, that's what abides. That's the refuge, is these qualities of the heart. So it's very delightful to me to be able to come and be here as a visitor, but to see these qualities of the heart, both as they have been over the last 20 years, and even more so now, being cultivated and nurtured, developed amongst the resident community, and then the community of all of you, because so many of the lay people gather today. Many of you I do know, but many I don't. Also, that faith has arisen and this has become your place, and that this is a place that nourishes and supports your own spiritual life. So I will close there. I've spoken, I think, for long enough now, and I am very, very glad indeed to share the blessings of this place with everyone, and may it long continue into the far future when all our memories have disappeared into smoke.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.